know, the title of the talk is What's the Price We Pay for Freedom? And another title is, I think it's Martin Luther King that said, you have nothing to lose but your shame. Correct me if someone else said it. And I think it's really relevant to our journey, our spiritual journey, that really we have nothing to lose but our shame. So, it's been, the word freedom has been used quite a lot in the last few days, and it's worth asking, actually, is this something I really want? And is this something that actually I need in my life? And is there a price that I have to pay for it? You could say, you know, I'm really happy in my life right now. Everything's fine. Except when it's not fine. Except when I'm sick. Except when I lose things that I value, or car needs fixing, or I experience pain, loss, death, maskanta. But otherwise life is great, and what do I need all this freedom stuff for? And freedom for what? Is the Buddhist view of freedom walking slowly like a zombie, or sitting doing nothing for hour after hour after hour? Is that what the Buddhists call freedom? Someone wrote me a note about, didn't God make me a creative person? And indeed, didn't God make me laugh, love, cry, do, get, play, dance? And if God made me do all these things, so why do I need to shut up and sit here? And people do ask very often, do I have to give up ambition, for example, drive, the phone, will? Because isn't the Buddhist teaching passive and telling you have to be, it's not really cool to be ambitious or to want things in life? Maybe you want to be more passive. Doesn't mean I'm going to sit on a park bench for the next few years in tell of his park somewhere. Mind you, Eckhart Tolle, when he had his awakening, which was totally sudden and unexpected, in the University of Cambridge in England, he was in deep depression, and probably you've read it in his book, The Power of Now. He was in deep depression, and he was about to commit suicide, and a little voice inside told him, well, if I know that I'm in depression, then there is a voice, there is someone inside that is not depressed, who knows this. And this is just, you know, stuff what we're doing here. But it was such for him a radical thought that he kind of collapsed unconscious, and he woke up in absolute bliss. And for 3 years he was doing nothing but sitting in park benches in Germany, England, Europe. You know, it's become one of the great world spiritual teachers. And really it started then, just this one event that happened to him. And he just sit around in park benches. It's true. So many of us would agree, yes, we would like to kind of get off the wheel. That I gave that image that of the hamster, the ogre going around the wheel. That our life is a bit like that, as we live on automatic pilot. There is an image in the Midrashim that life a very scary image of samsara, really. Although Jewish version, samsara, comes from the Midrash or Talmud. Did I not say samsara? Well, this is what samsara is. It's the images of that the human beings are like insects, harakim, in a jar, that go up and up and fall down, and climb up and up and fall down, and climb up and up and fall down. And that's quite a scary image of samsara. Samsara is a Buddhist word meaning the wheel of life, where the sense like, yes, we are hamsters in a wheel, going round, 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 and then we die. A few rounds, yes, indeed, many. And so many of us would say, yeah, we want to stop, but if it means I've got to stop all my ambitions and my needs and my drives and my will and my sex and my, you know, creativity and so on, I want to get off the wheel a little bit, only. But not really get off, because it's just too exciting, this wheel. So, to be honest, this view is a limited vision. That if we really think that our life actually is about the dancing and the love and the creativity and the ambition and getting places and doing things, we're actually forgetting it's a partial view. Because when we're full of health, we forget that we're sick. When we're young and energetic, we forget that we'll be old. When we are alive, we forget that we'll be dying. When we are ambitious, we forget what it's like when someone else wins and we are down. When we're up, we forget that when we go down. So it's kind of a rather limited view of what is life for us. And as soon as we kind of wake up to the reality, we realize that when there's up, there's always down, and then it makes us stop and take stock and look a bit more carefully. And so this is really one of the values of suffering, why the Buddha gave suffering as the first noble truth. It's just a reality check. Otherwise we get in the illusion that everything is great and we forget the suffering. The suffering simply makes us wake up. It's not that the Buddhist teaching is all about suffering. It's just about not ignoring suffering as being an integral part of our experience in this body. And therefore, it's a wake-up call to look and see what's going on. And one of the teachings of the Buddha is about, it's called the Eight Conditions. And it's really sort of Buddhist biology. And it says that all beings, including the harakim, the insects in the jar, are basically driven by eight conditions. They want pleasure and not pain. They want having and not losing. They want to be acknowledged or accepted or have to be seen, to be, and not to be rejected and pushed away. They want love and not hate. So, kind of driven by needs, which are very basic needs. And it makes the wheel go round, these needs. And therefore in them is quite a lot of pain. Because what really makes the wheel go round is these needs. For example, if you say, I need ambition and energy and drive, it's good for me, it gives me life. But how much of that life is simply the ego that wants to be somewhere and wants to be somebody and wants to be someone important and wants to be better than the next guy, and I want to have this mark in my exam, my this, my that, or I want to have this amount of money better than that amount of money, or so much of that is driven by self, by the selfing, by the eight conditions, by the need, and therefore quite painful. And very often the most beautiful things in life are in a way contaminated by the self. Love, the most beautiful thing in our life, is so contaminated by the ego, what I want. I will only love work providing the other person does what I want, for example, or agrees with me, or loves me back, or with deals. And then love, when it's not, it doesn't have those needs, the ego needs, turns into anger and turns into despair. And then we fall out of love and we think love doesn't exist anymore. And then we get depressed. And sort of love is the most beautiful thing. Is it, if you just watch it, is held hostage by the forces of ego, the forces of self, the forces of needs and eight conditions. So it's really a question of looking more carefully at the those things that we think are really so wonderful in life, and really asking what is it that we do with them. And maybe the other things are as important or more important, the things we don't want. There's a quote from somebody that, forget where I read it in a Buddhist newspaper, and he said, I used to think that if I could really live fully, except for all the obstacles, for all the problems that arise. Now, I realize that the problems that arise are the real life. Before I say it again, I forgot exactly the quote, but before I thought real life can be, I could have real life except for all the problems that keep coming up. Now I know the problems that keep coming up are a real life. And so it's a different view, it's a view more truthful and more clear. And for that, we need to look in the mirror to really see what our life is like and what happens when we do act and when we do want things and when we do love and when we do dance, what really, and when we are healthy and when we are sick, when we are living and when we are dying. For that, we need to look in the mirror. That is not, we're no longer in the place where we can't afford to be in illusion. The cost of illusion is higher than the cost of apparently having a great time. Da'atmecha is the number one rule, because it's not any Buddhist to say that. Da'atmecha, know yourself. Look in the mirror. And for that, to do that, very often we have to stop. And the only thing we're doing in this retreat, really, is just stopping long enough to look in the mirror, because it's quite difficult to do it when we're keeping running around in circles in our ordinary life. It is, of course, possible, and we can do it, and we should do it, and we do do it, but it's sometimes necessary also just to stop and say, wait, in order to do this properly, to look in the mirror, that's what I'm going to do now. For a week, I'm going to come here and look in the mirror and do nothing else. And sometimes we need to give ourselves that space. So it's not that Buddhists have to sit up all their life in silent meditation the rest of their life and not live. It's just so we give ourselves this time and this attention and this concentration to look in the mirror, to get off the wheel for a while and see the truth that comes up for us. So the Dharma actually doesn't ask anybody to stop anything. And people always ask, you know, well, I'm a soldier in the Tsava, in the Israeli army. Does the Dharma say I have to stop being a soldier? Or I'm a businessman. Does the Dharma say I have to stop being a businessman? Or I'm a dentist. Or I treat the floor. The Dharma doesn't. The Dharma is much, much more interested in how you do things than what you do. What's the quality of your actions as a soldier. Okay, you're serving in the army, that's your choice. You don't want to leave the army, you do want to serve in the army, okay. That's your choice. As in Krishna and in Bhagavad Gita, sometimes there is no choice. Your life puts you there. How are you as a soldier? Are you compassionate? Are you aware? Are you doing something that's worth it? That's much more interesting than whether you're a soldier or not a soldier. The Dharma doesn't tell you what to do. The Dharma is all about how you do things. With what is the quality, the mind, the attention, the awareness, and the freedom inside our ordinary life. And if you want to be a monk, you can be a monk. I can tell you that monks can be just as busy and just as much on the wheel as others. Sometimes not, but sometimes you go to Zen monastery and you'll be working morning, noon and night, cleaning, sweeping, cutting, cooking. It's a joke what's going on here. This is holiday compared to going to the Zen monastery. So you know, don't think that the monastics are always sitting on their ass doing nothing. It can be even harder. And part of the concern is sometimes that, well, if I back off and meditate, then actually maybe, and I'm not in the kind of running of life, so maybe life passes me by because I won't be good at things. I'll be meditating and I won't be able to be a good writer or a good this or a good something. Because I'm meditating, and meditating is not skill at this or skill at that. It, like in a sense, I lose my drive, I lose my will. I often think that the best example of this, and it is the real questions that come up from people, by the way. This is not just that I'm inventing this. Again and again and again, the same questions come up. If I'm a mindfulness practitioner, a Buddhist meditator, will I just lose the capacity and interest to really do things in life from the inside? And an example that I often give, I believe will actually get better at doing things when as a result of mindful attention and inner freedom. And an example of this that I find is making choices. For making choices, if you're not used to looking and seeing who you really are, making a choice can be an absolute nightmare. I remember, you know, when I was teenage and before university, I spent months and months and months in terrible stress and trying to work out whether I should study this or study that or go this direction or go that direction in my life or what. And it was awful. And many people find making decisions a real nightmare. That goes on and on, and the mind turning, 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 this way, that way. Is it better like this? Is it better like that? Maybe it's better for me there. Maybe it's better for me there. What will be if I do this? And what will be if I do that? And checking it out, and trying to do the research, and failing, and trying again, and failing, and it never works. And in the end, out of exhaustion, completely exhausted, you make a decision. Okay, I'll go this way. Well, you might as well start done it at the beginning, actually. Save yourself all that trouble. Could have done it right at the beginning, because when the decision is made, it's anyway made in the present, in one moment, right? If you have those tools, you can make the decision in the present, in one moment. What are those tools? The tools of awareness, of inner freedom, of a sense of a bigger mind that knows itself. And then you know this is right for me. You just know it. And the decision is made. And so, you know, here's a good example that actually I think powers increase as the powers of your mind increase and expand. And it doesn't matter where they expand to, they can expand to your feet, like we're doing walking meditation. Just putting the mind in the feet, that's fine, that's bigger mind. So with a bigger mind, we negotiate with life much more easily, much better. I mean, another example might be sickness. How much this practice can help us when we're sick. I mean, many, many people who have really experienced this, that a sickness such as a cancer, which could make you utterly miserable, totally finished, stressed, anxious, afraid, giving hell to yourself, hell to everybody else, complaining about the medical world, complaining about everything, complaining about God, or using the sickness as a way for inner transformation and being fine. Yes, there is sickness, but I am inside here, I am okay. The sickness in the body, but I'm okay. And it's kind of such a big difference. You see it so much different with the power that comes from this kind of meeting yourself truly and deeply in the mirror. So, a couple of points about why is it that sometimes it seems so difficult to look in the mirror? Why is it that the example I gave the other day of the Zen story that someone is, you know, going on the search and met the Zen master and he asked what's the ultimate truth, and the Zen master took all his wood that he was carrying and put it down. Trouble is, we want to take all the wood we're carrying and put it down. And as we were talking in a group a couple of days ago, the wood simply sticks. It doesn't go down. It gets stuck. We still find ourselves carrying it. We want to put it down and it doesn't go down. Example would be anger. We're carrying anger on our shoulders. We want to put it down. No one wants anger. We don't want to have this thing that keeps coming up every time we feel threatened or someone says something to us we don't like. We don't want it. We can't get rid of it. And it's not easy here. We sit with it and it comes up and then it comes up again and it comes up again and we look at it and we do exactly what Yonatan and Sandhya and Stephen and the Buddha and doing exactly the, you know, according to the book. And here he does again, and here he does again, and here he does again. And it doesn't go. And why sometimes does it seem so difficult? If really, what is the wheel really so? But are we really stuck on the wheel? Is it really so difficult to get off? And so I think here we need a little understanding. In the practice, we need patience. But a little understanding here can help us. And without going into the whole Buddhist psychology, we thoroughly recommend that all of you learn it, and we're having courses on it, and do investigate Buddhist psychology, because it's an incredible field. But one aspect of it is this concept called sankhara. And sankhara is a word that means construction. Construction is us. As we arise into this body, we arise into a construction, a building, a form. And all our life we are building ourselves as a form, as form. And there is a like readiness. We are very ready from the moment of our zero, when we came out of the womb and before, every child, the intensity of a child that wants to learn. Who am I? What to do? What's the language? Where do I go? How is life? You know, non-stop, this high, intense wanting to learn means wanting to have form. And we're still doing it. We want form. We need form. We are form. Our body is a form. So sankhara is a construction. You can look at it like engravings in the mind. Or in neurobiology, the kind of neural network of brain cells that seem kind of fixed. Like in our brain is a network of brain cells. That is a tree. and recognizes because of this network existing, we know a tree is a tree. So we have networks in the brain, and they're quite fixed. And so sankharas are these constructions. And they feel fixed because they, because of the tendencies that keep every generation and every, maybe for thousands of lifetimes, this construction has been being constructed. So there's a huge habit that insects is busy trying to learn to be an insect. The cat is busy trying to learn how to be a good cat and do what cats do. There's a force that is constructing us all the time. And it's the force of karma. And karma is a force, the pressure on a free being to become constructed, to make form, to be a form. We are born because of karma into a body. It's a construction. So it's kind of, you need to understand that when we look in the mind, we see stories and stories and stories. Who am I? Who am I? What am I? My anger, my fears, my history, my past narrative, past experience that I'm building all the time. There are sankharas in the mind. So we are constructed, therefore these constructions seem very real and they seem very strong. They don't really belong to us in the first place, they belong to karma. And it's quite helpful to say, you know, okay, I have anger, but it's not really my anger. Life, karma made this anger in me. One of the most useful qualities of this concept, still a concept, karma is a concept or a view or an understanding, but it's very helpful because it in a way takes away responsibility from me, the poor individual that has to be responsible for everything that I do or happens to me. It's a little bit, we can relax a little bit, these things grow in us because of the force of karma, which is much bigger than this one body. Just to put that in the back of your mind. And it can help us understand the present is built again and again on the model of the moment before. That's karma. The blueprint, the design of the now is built from the design of the moment before. In Buddhism, there's no creator, Bore Olam. Karma is the best equivalent of Bore Olam. And karma just means the rolling pressure of form to make more form, like itself. To keep doing, making rolling form, creating form, based on previous form. So, that's why it's somewhat difficult, because of the habit energy of something like anger. It's got a lot of habit energy in it from thousands of lifetimes, in a way, and certainly from our life, from when we were born. But, that's not the whole story. The other side of it is that these things, like forms, like habits, are not actually fully us. They are stuck on us, that we have a place of freedom which is not the anger, which is not the narrative or the story, which is not the form of this body. There is a place of freedom which is not that. And a very nice way that the nice image in the Buddhist teaching is that all these things, that habits, that give us trouble are like stains on the cloth. And the cloth is pure white cloth. That's the cloth of our consciousness. Stuck onto it are stains, samim. So a tekken would be anger, or a tekken would be some habit that we don't like, some psychological habit, or a tekken could be a narrative that's going around, or it can be things that kind of imprison us. So the image of these as stains on the cloth, but that's a kind of there's something very, very helpful about that image, which is that the cloth is pure, and the stain has arrived, and that the image is cleaning the cloth will get rid of the stain. It's not that the cloth is made of these stains. The stains are stuck to a pure cloth, white cloth. Cleaning the cloth will reveal again the white, pure cloth. Just you need to clean it. You need to wash it. One of the troubles we have is that the water that we use to wash the stains is quite dirty. So we find ourselves having to purify our mind with an impure mind. All we've got is the mind that we have, which is full of narratives, this, that, that. And we have to clean the narratives, this, that, and this, that. So we're in a little bit of a loop here. Thankfully, there is the clean cloth which stands behind it. And we find there is in us a place of a pure being, a pure mind, which is able to be a witness of a narrative. We stand out of it, and this pure mind that can witness a narrative, a problem, an issue, an anger, a fear, is not the fear, the anger. The witness is not the thing it's seeing. So we do have faith in the mind. It's not entirely dirty water, it actually can clean the stain. But it does take time, and it does take effort, and it is a process, and we do need patience. One of the issues when we think of the process as being quite difficult, and we get a bit despaired because, as I say, the anger keeps coming back again. So why doesn't it get clean? And we get frustrated a bit. We go to 3, 4, 5 retreats, and then we sit another retreat, and our body's still full of pain. Well, I've sat already, I haven't had better retreats before. Why is it that now my body is hurting and maybe I'm going back to Kita Alam? One of the issues, firstly, is forgetting about karma. Because karma, we're not in control. In a certain way, karma will do what it wants to do. We need to do what we can do, but karma does what it wants to do. So we're not really in control of what exactly our experience will be. Neither now, or in 5 minutes, or in 1 year's time. We're not in control of what exactly we will experience. So we better just sort of relax around that and not expect too much. But the other thing is that we tend to, with the ordinary mind is full of measuring. The ordinary mind, the self, basically, is actually busy measuring all the time. How far did I get? What do I need? How fast is it going for me? How was it compared to yesterday? How was it compared to the last retreat? Am I making progress? All that stuff going on around and around and around is about outcome, or sort of result. So the mind goes there, as what is one of the sankharas, is measuring result. If the result is like this, I feel happy. If the result is like this, half happy. If the result is like this, oh no, I'm just slipping here, nothing is going right for me. It's measuring. Is there truth in that? How much truth is there in that? So much better to drop the measuring and be just with the means, not the end, the way and not the result. Not to measure results, but to be with the way, with the thing itself, with the process, and not the outcome. It's okay to be pleased and happy when something good happens to us, fine. But not then to use it as a basis for measuring. And some of you will have interesting experiences here, maybe very joyful or blissful experiences here, have to be careful about that. But after that, the whole retreat is built around whether I get it back, how good it was compared to today and tomorrow, and so on. It's so much human to do that, but it doesn't help us. So one of the places is simply to drop the measuring. And then we might find that this question, why is it so difficult? Why is the load of sticks on the shoulder of this? Why does it keep getting stuck in me? I can't drop it really. Awakening is not something that we get, that we grab. The freedom that we're talking about is not something that we grab. Put it in the pocket, I have it. Mine, okay. Wonderful yogi and a super dharma dweller. Go out in the world and change the world. The cloth has stains on it, meaning the cloth is clean to begin with. Meaning that awakening is there to begin with. It's not something that we get. Is something already there. Particularly in the Buddhist teaching, our task is to uncover what is already there. The stains on the cloth are covering like this. So we can't really see the awakened mind. We can't see the pure being. Because we just see the form, the sankhara. That's what we see. We're inside the sankhara. So the Buddhist teaching is very, very, very consistent about this. There's almost one thing it says. There's almost one sentence, which is, there is nothing worth holding on to. There is nothing worth clinging to. Clinging. Because if we keep letting go of everything, not attaching, not clinging, not holding on, then the purity reveals itself. We don't have to run after it. We just have to keep, in a way, uncovering by not clinging, not holding on, not getting attached, holding on to sankhara. Sankharas are forms. If we hold on to them, then they're here. If we don't hold on to them, they go themselves. We wash them out from the cloth. And our practice here has an amazing, amazing aspect to it. That just like the stains appear and get stuck, when we really look at what these stains are, we find two things. One is, they're not really made of anything. And the second is, they go away by themselves. It's an extraordinary thing. I want two sentences about each one of those. if you try and look carefully at a story or at a thought, the story can be a narrative, like a narrative like I'm no good. You put judgment, self-judgment. I can't do this. I'm no good at life. Other people are better. It's a narrative. It's a pain. It's a stain on the cloth. It keeps coming back. It gets into a habit. If we really look directly at that narrative in our own mind, it's like a bubble. There's nothing there. If we really look at the sensation in the body, it's a bubble. What is it? Nothing there. To really look carefully at anything, it disappears. Same. So the nature is the karma creates forms, but the forms are like an illusion. They're like a dream. And the sankharas themselves are like dreams. If we look carefully at them, we see that they're made of insubstantial. They're not really substantial. A tree, so we look out there, what is it? In terms of the brain, it is a network of cells in the brain. There's no tree in the brain. Growing, the olive tree growing here, and a pine tree, orange, grows here, and the cattlaus is growing here. There's no trees in the brain. They are connections that that give a sort of symbolic tree. And then we say, I know, there's a tree. There's no tree. Who says there's a tree? When we look carefully, it's just ionin in the brain. Just electric waves in the brain. So when we look, we see that there really isn't anything solid, that the things that are present that give us difficulty are actually not solid at all. They don't. They're illusions. And the second thing is, we don't need to get rid of them actively, because they get rid of themselves. We just have to see and look and watch how they come and how they go. There is a big the Western psychology world, because Western psychology is basically influenced, and here, psychologists here, please, I don't want to get lots of stuff in tomorrow saying, what do you say, what's all this about? I just don't feel like arguing this case. I'll say what I want to say, and who cares? No fear. Thank you for sitting here. Or the Israel Psychological Association will throw me out. But Freud and the whole psychological movement of the 20th century is influenced by a materialistic worldview which says there are things in the brain called complexes, called stories that we have to uncover, that sit in the subconscious, they're like demons in there, they're all solid things, and we have to uncover them and understand them and talk about them and spend some years busy with them because they're things there. And the Dharma says, wait a minute, if you look at anything in the mind, you see that it comes and goes. And therefore, all you really need to do is to watch carefully, again and again and again and again, at anything that oppresses you, with a clear, mindful awareness, receiving it as it is, looking the demon in the eyes, and you'll see he comes and he goes. And when he's gone, he is gone. And they come back, force of karma. Okay, but he's not something sitting there in us. So then the next time, again, you look at him, the anger comes up, the narrative comes up, you look at him, he's gone. He comes up again, he's gone. Need some patience, but by their nature, these things don't have solidity. They're not solid things sitting in the conscious, subconscious, whatever. And when the Buddha, every time the Buddha saw Mara, Mara used to come. Mara is the equivalent of the Satan, the shed, or something. But he was really the voice of the Sankaras, embodied as a kind of an image of a demon. But all the Buddha would say is, Mara, I've seen you. And then he would collapse and disappear. There was no fighting. And again and again, through thousands of pages of Buddhist texts, the same thing every time. Mara would come, dressed up as something else, sometimes dressed up as something apparently very attractive. The Buddha would say, I see you. And he would say, and collapse and just vanish. Just to be seen is enough. If you see it full on, with all your awareness, see their narratives as they arise, and see that they really do go. And then they arise and they go. So slowly, slowly, when in the title of the talk, you have nothing to lose but your change, I should also add that the change lose themselves. That they drop themselves in a certain way they never were there. They're constructed by habits, they're constructed by the past, they're constructed by karma, but they're not really. The question is, they're really there. We believe them to be there, but when we look closely, we may not find them, even though they seem to be so imprisoning us. So I'd like to finish by reading one of my favourite quotes of a kind of an awakened view. William Blake is one of my favourite authors of all time, and recently I've been reading him again after many, many years when I sort of forgot about William Blake. And he says, to see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, to hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. So it takes 2 minutes of quiet. Before we go out to walk, I'd like to read a quote from Asankar that I was going to read before and I forgot that I had it. Asankar is really a kind of the father, grandfather of the kind of lineage of the practice that we're practicing here. That we're practicing here really according to a certain line or tradition of Buddhist teachers. We didn't just invent it sitting together in Beit Cafe in Tel Aviv. It's got quite a long history. And I mean this particular kind of way we practice, style. Dharmacharya is really, I suppose, a sort of father of this, grandfather of this kind of practice. And he wrote many things, and I just want to read one thing that he wrote here about what I said this evening. About this mind, in truth, there is nothing really wrong with it. It is intrinsically pure. Within itself, it's already peaceful. But the mind is not peaceful is when it follows mood. The real mind doesn't have anything to it. It's simply an aspect of nature. It becomes peaceful or disturbed because mood deceives it. Sense impressions, senses, come and trick it into happiness, suffering, gladness, and sorrow. But the true nature of the mind is none of these things. The gladness or the sadness is not the mind, but just a mood coming to deceive us. The untrained mind gets lost and follows things. It forgets itself. And then we think that it is we who are upset or glad or sad or at ease or whatever. But really, this mind of ours is already unmoving and peaceful, really peaceful. Just like a leaf, which is still, as long as no wind blows. If a wind comes, the leaf flutters. The fluttering is due to the wind. The fluttering of the mind is due to those sense impressions. The mind follows them. If it doesn't follow them, it doesn't flutter. Our practice is simply to see the original mind. Train the mind to know those sense impressions, but not to get lost in them. Just this is the aim of all this difficult practice we put ourselves through.